I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 7th of April, Monday at 1. It's all things political. Jamel Bowie is our guest now, and he is quite recently a staff writer for Slate. He was at the Daily Beast for some time. He writes about politics, policy, and race. His reporting and analysis has appeared in The American Prospect, The Nation, The Atlantic, CNN.com, and The Washington Post. We'll start with the Supreme Court McCutcheon decision, the right of individuals to put as much as $3.6 million into political parties and $800,000 into a political campaign. The Supreme Court Justice Roberts said that there is no right more basic in our democracy than the right to participate in electing our political leaders. E.J. Dionne had a column today saying that it's a shame that the Republican majority on the Supreme Court doesn't know the difference between an oligarchy and a democratic republic. We have a lot to talk about today. The Obama administration front page story today, deporting illegal immigrants at a record pace, and two-thirds of the nearly 2 million deportations involve people who have committed only minor infractions. Our guest wrote an interesting piece about liberals counting on population trends to doom Republicans to a long-term minority, and they should not do that. He writes about how Republicans rationalize voter suppression. We'll talk about the resignation of the CEO of Mozilla, Brendan Eich, and Frank Bruni's piece in the New York Times yesterday, The New Gay Orthodoxy. Increasingly, opposition to gay marriage is being equated to racism. Those are some of the stories we'll be covering, and we welcome your participation as always to reach us. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. All of those ways of reaching us are open to you right now. Hello, Jamel. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Well, let's start with the Supreme Court McCutcheon decision last week. Individuals can put a whole lot of money into political parties. Does it, as critics are saying, drown out the voices of individual citizens? And why, again, is this another decision where those on the court who are put there by Republican presidents vote a certain way, those who are put there by Democratic presidents vote another way?
Well, I think the reason why this comes down to such a partisan divide is that there really is a firm ideological divide between conservatives and liberals and where money stands as speech. I think many conservatives believe firmly that money is indistinguishable from speech. And so there's no reason or there's no the justification for limiting it from politics seems to be very, very high. Liberals, on the other hand, see money much more instrumentally. Money may be a way of procuring speech, but it isn't speech per se, and the influence of money in politics needs to be balanced against other concerns. With this particular case, you know, I think liberals have the better of the argument. It would be one thing if all Americans, middle class, lower income, and wealthy, had the money to donate to politicians in large sums, but they don't. We know, as a matter of sort of empirical reality, that politicians are much more likely to respond to rich Americans above their lower-income counterparts. And so what the Supreme Court ruling has done is simply added another, or I think it's added another, and it's given the wealthy another opportunity, another means for which to send the message to politicians, express their opinions, and so on and so forth. And I think this can, over the long term, be corrosive, because I think it does begin to crowd out the ability of people without the means to donate to create PACs, to create super PACs. Mm-hmm. It crowds out their ability to contribute.
Did you expect this decision, Jamel, or did you expect perhaps one of the justices on either side who had been appointed by somebody from his party to break ranks?
You know, this, given how the court ruled in Citizens United, I expected this decision completely. It's consistent with the view expressed in Citizens United that corporations have free speech rights that are worth respecting. In fact, there will almost certainly be another case around campaign finance. And my expectation is that with this future hypothetical case, the court will end up striking down the limits on individual giving, since if the limit to aggregate giving is unconstitutional, it's sort of hard to see how you can justify a limit to giving to a particular candidate or a particular organization.
Mm-hmm. And what doors are open to you, do you think, Jamil, if you do give a lot of money? Are your phone calls answered?
Yeah, it's your phone calls being answered. It's simply the fact, you know, if as a function of my job, I had to spend 4 hours a day, 5 hours a day, 6 hours a day, calling extremely wealthy people and finding a way to convince them to give me some of their money and flattering them and telling them mm-hmm. that their opinions matter. Eventually, that's going to weigh somewhat on my thinking about the world around me. It's something sinister. It's just the way humans work and interact.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not so much the case of a case of quid pro quo or sort of explicit corruption. It's just when politicians in both parties are devoting so much of their time to interacting with the wealthiest Americans, it's going to create a blinkered view, and it's going to create a view or encourage a view that views their interest as sort of primary and others less so.
And most recently, not that the Democrats don't do this as well, but you look at the Republican potential candidates for the presidency who are bowing before Sheldon Adelson's feet not very long ago, just begging to have him listen to them because he's worth $80 billion.
Exactly. I mean, it's an embarrassing spectacle for politicians to be so solicitous of the super wealthy. But it's the world that the court has steadily created by privileging money as equivalent or equal to political speech.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to voting. The same Supreme Court, some would say, really looked at voting rights and did a great deal to take away some of the protections for the rights of minorities to participate in electing our political leaders. You wrote an interesting piece recently, How Republicans Rationalize Voter Suppression. What do you see as the most damaging kinds of voter suppression that are around right now, and how have Republicans rationalized that?
I think what's so damaging about voter suppression laws is that it's a bundle of different things. You know, if it were just voter identification alone, then there are ways you can deal with that. If it were just closing early voting, ending early voting hours, or ending weekend voting, or restricting the geography of where you can vote, that would be one thing. But for the combination of strict voter identification, ending early voting, ending weekend voting, making it harder to vote absentee, making it harder to vote provisionally, so on and so forth, creates sort of a world where it's just harder to vote, especially if you are on the margins of society. You know, if you look at the rhetoric in states which have passed these sorts of laws, the rationalization, the explanation is we have to protect voter integrity. We have to ensure uniformity between between districts. But these words are being defined in an odd way. Voter integrity here means making sure that the voters are who they say they are. But you don't need to end early voting hours to do that. You don't need to have highly restrictive voter ID laws to do that. You can sort of determine if someone is who they say they are by having, you know, easy to obtain universal voter IDs. That's assuming even that this is a problem. Most studies of the phenomena of in-person voter fraud have found that it's basically non-existent, that it's not a thing. But if it's a concern, you can deal with it in an easy way that doesn't burden a lot of people. Likewise, if your concern is that, say, rural counties have to comply with voting regulations that don't really apply, only really apply to urban counties or high-density counties, then create flexibility in the law to allow those rural counties to not utilize or be able to opt out of those regulations. it doesn't make any sense to say, oh, well, the urban counties now have to conform to the demands of rural counties. I know in Wisconsin, where early voting hours were cut, what the practical effect of this will be is that in order to fit the number of people who voted early in 2012 into the voting hours for 2014 in a rural district, you know, you have to have roughly 30 or 40 voter every 30 or 40 minutes, totally reasonable. In order to do it for an urban district, you have to have a voter basically every 9 seconds.
Wow.
And, you know, that's not going to happen. And so the practical consequence is that there are going to be fewer people voting early because there'll be longer lines, there'll be fewer opportunities, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's when you look at the rationalizations and you see their effects and you see how you could easily fulfill the concerns through means that aren't actually keeping people from the polls, it's hard to look at this as something other than an attempt to suppress the votes of poor Americans, minority Americans, and other groups.
The voter ID, as you know, in the state of Wisconsin is being heard. It was challenged, and we're awaiting a court decision on the state level and also on the federal level. Eventually, I would imagine these will go to the U.S. Supreme Court, and you have to wonder if the Chief Justice will say the same thing he said in his McClutchin opinion. There is no right more basic in our democracy than the right to participate in electing our political leaders.
No, I would hope so. My concern is that Roberts has shown a remarkable concern for the ability of very wealthy people to participate in politics, but less of that concern for the ability of many groups of people to have access to the vote. I mean, the voting rights opinion all but declared that there wasn't a problem of voting discrimination anymore, despite the fact that just 7 years earlier, both houses of Congress and the White House were united in saying, in fact, that there was a problem of voting discrimination, and that it was the federal government's business to do something about it. So I hope John Roberts and the Roberts Court largely decides to, put its foot forward in protecting the ability of the people to vote. But I'm not optimistic.
Mm. We're going to take phone calls on both of those issues. They're important ones. Let me give you our phone number because we'll go to your call shortly. What do you think of the Supreme Court McCutchin decision? What do you think about if you were ruling consistently, would you vote then to get rid of anything that makes it more difficult for people who don't have as much money to vote? We'll talk about that. We have equal time for Democrats here in a moment because we're going to talk about the Obama administration deporting illegal immigrants. But here's how you reach our conversation for all things political. It's 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Today's New York Times, I'm sure you saw this, the Obama administration deporting illegal immigrants at a record pace. Since he took office, two-thirds of the nearly 2 million deportation cases involve people who have committed only minor infractions. What's he doing?
Yeah, I think this was originally envisioned as a way to buy support for comprehensive immigration reform. I think the thinking of the administration in 2009 and 2010 was if we really crack down on the borders, if we really show that we are committed to upholding existing immigration law, then we can convince skeptical Republicans to sign on with a comprehensive bill that would provide a path to citizenship. Since they would know that that the enforcement mechanisms in this bill would be enforced. I think as we can clearly see over the last 2 years that bet has not paid off, but the administration remains committed to this really, I think, draconian approach to deportations. And so I'm not really sure where the White House is going with this. There's almost nothing Obama can do to convince the most right-wing members of the House Republican Caucus that he is committed to enforcing immigration law. And at the same time, he is really alienating millions of Latino voters. The large majority of those deported are Latino. He's alienating people who voted for him in hopes that he would do something about either the tenuous immigration status of their friends or their families or their loved ones. It's honestly for me a little baffling to see the White House continue to go this route, despite there being no real gain and a lot of pain being caused.
And yet another one of those issues, Jamel, that you wonder why in the world could not Congress have addressed this? Because everybody agreed that there was a problem with our immigration policy. Why in the world can't you get together and figure something out?
Well, I mean, the thing is that in the Senate, Republicans and Democrats were able to come together to figure something out. It probably was not as expansive or not as lenient as what would have been preferred by some folks on the left, and it probably wasn't as strict and harsh as what some folks on the right would have preferred. But the Gang of Eight package sort of satisfied the broad concerns of most people in the Senate and many activists on both sides. The problem came in the House, where you do probably have a majority of House members, Democrats, and a small number of Republicans who support the Gang of Eight bill or something similar to it. But you have John Boehner, who is sort of wrangling a caucus that is mostly opposed to comprehensive immigration reform. And he is unwilling to introduce something that would rely on Democratic votes to pass. And so the stumbling block here, I don't think, is Congress. The stumbling block here is a minority of Congress that doesn't represent the majority of American people, but is suspicious of comprehensive immigration reform, suspicious of Obama, and unwilling to budge because they don't view it as necessary.
To phone calls from our listeners and other forms of messages, our guest this hour for All Things Political is Jamel Bowie, who recently has become a staff writer for Slate. He was at the Daily Beast. He writes about politics, policy, and race. He has written for The Nation, The Atlantic, CNN.com, The Washington Post, The American Prospect. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And you can also find us on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Particularly interested because we didn't have a chance to talk about the Supreme Court decision last week, but this McCutcheon decision, which some people are saying just opens the floodgates to really heavy, heavy amounts of money coming in, as if we didn't already have heavy amounts of money coming in now from individuals. And what about the voices of individual citizens? Does it drown them out? We have talked about the Supreme Court eventually hearing, I'm sure, on appeal, voter ID. And we're looking at the deportation policy of the President Obama administration. And this is a front page story today on the New York Times. Lots and lots of people, 2 million deportation cases, and 2/3 are not people who are drug offenders or convicted of any serious crime. They have been convicted of minor infractions. So what do you think about any of those issues? We'd like to hear from you. I gave you the number. All right, we'll be to you in a moment. This is All Things Political on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. Lee in Green Bay is our first caller for you, Jamel. Hi, Lee.
Hi.
Hi.
I just have two comments. One, I wanted to comment on the voter ID issue that guest is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like 66 years old. I've lived in this country all my life, born, raised here, served in the military. ID has been a part of my life ever since I was a child. I mean, I got my Social Security card when I was a little kid. Now, to say that, this is going to hurt, a huge group of people, if you can reach them and tell them to go get these things, then it's not an issue. I don't understand how we're using this to put this issue down, And the other thing I wanted to comment on was the immigration issue. It just drives me nuts. These people, they're deporting people. He's enforcing the law. these, yes, some of them haven't committed serious crimes. They've committed crime. Those are the people that he's after. Those are the people that they're enforcing this, you know, over. There's a huge part of this population, I believe, that believes the same way I do. They just don't have a voice. And I'll take my question. I'll take my answer.
All right, Lee. Thanks for the call. Jamil.
So about voter ID, I think the important thing to recognize is that there is a substantial portion of the American population that sort of exists outside of what you'd call the formal economy. These are people who are usually very low income, who work typically for cash or, you know, very low wages, and they may not have a bank. They may rely on, say, check cashing services. They may not have a car, so they wouldn't have car registration and they wouldn't have a driver's license. A lot of things that, you know, we take for granted that everyone has, in fact, many people don't have. I don't think that should keep someone from being able to vote, which is why I think that if we are going to have voter ID, it should be something that's extremely easy to obtain and provided for people. But, you know, requiring driver's license, requiring a hunting license, requiring a student ID, these aren't things that everyone has, and whether or not you have them depends a lot on your income. And so requiring them seems to be, you know, even if there's nothing sinister about it, even if it's just we want to make sure people who they say they are, requiring them can end up excluding people for no good reason. As for immigration, you know, I think it's worth emphasizing whenever we talk about, you know, the illegality of coming into the United States without authorization, that crossing a border is a civil crime. It's in the same category legally as jaywalking. It's not a criminal offense to cross a border. And so when we're thinking about how we address unauthorized immigrants, I think we need to consider it in those terms. Unless someone has committed a crime in the United States, not just a civil offense, but a crime, I think we should think very carefully about deporting them, because these are people with families, with friends, with neighbors. They are integral to their jobs. They do pay taxes. They pay payroll taxes. They pay sales taxes. They're people who, with a good policy change, could become fully integrated members of the American community. So, you know, I understand the frustration with, you know, the idea that someone's come across the border without following all the proper channels and may or may not be, you know, using particular social services or so on and so forth. But I think we need to recognize that, A, you know, quote-unquote illegal immigrants are people who've committed civil offense, not a criminal one. And many of these people are law-abiding, and while they may not pay federal income tax, they certainly pay a whole host of other taxes.
This is a good time now to bring up Jeb Bush, because Jeb Bush is suddenly all over the place. He was on Fox News Latino today, actually, and talked about the immigration issue and had some interesting things to say. I'd like to get your response to this. He said that those who come into the country illegally generally do so because they had no other means to provide for their family, and what they did is not a felony. He said it's an act of love. It's an act of commitment to your family. I honestly think that that is a different kind of crime. There should be a price paid, but it shouldn't rile people up that people are actually coming to this country to provide for their families.
I am, I think it would be fair to identify myself as a liberal, and I'm not particularly sympathetic to Jeb Bush and a wide variety of issues, but this is one where I am. I think part of the problem with our immigration discourse is that we don't pay enough attention to the humanity of unauthorized immigrants. And many of them, they are not criminals. They're not people trying to, quote, take anyone's job or use anyone's benefits. They are here to find a better life for them and their families, no different than, you know, the millions of immigrants who came to this country in an earlier age. Many of them, it should be said, came here without the proper authorization. It would strain credulity to believe that every single Italian and every single Irish and every single Eastern European immigrant to this country in the 19th and early 20th centuries was quote, legal. They almost certainly weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And they were coming here for the same reasons that today's Latino and African and Asian American immigrants are coming, to better themselves and their families. And I have just a basic sympathy for that. And so I think Bush is absolutely right. We can still say that they have to pay some price for their civil offense, whether that is fee, back taxes, so on and so forth. But to treat them as criminals, I think, is to, disrespect the basic reason, it's to disrespect a lot of what Americans love about their country, which is that this is a place that people will risk a lot mm-hmm. to come to improve their lives and those of their families.
Later in the hour, I'll ask you if you think he is the Republicans' contender for 2016, and if Hillary is the Democratic. Wouldn't that be something? We've got people whose families have been at the pinnacle of power at other times in history, and it's looking like those may be the nominees. We'll ask our guest what he thinks about that. Let's go back to phone calls. Willem in Colfax is next. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I just wanted to say that about the Supreme Court ruling, this one and the Citizens United case, I think both of them, whether you're a conservative or a liberal or a libertarian, or no matter what political affiliation you have, I think this is a really they keep referring to it as the conservative court, but this is a radical court. This decision takes things back to the way they were before the American Revolution, where people with inherited wealth, the aristocracy, and powerful companies like the British East India Company controlled the lives of everyday citizens. So I don't think, and I heard someone say this about money and speech, which I thought was a very excellent point, is that money is not speech. Money amplifies speech. So I don't have the ability, like, say, the Koch brothers or this Edelman man, to spend millions and millions and millions of dollars influencing the political system. I don't think it was ever meant to be that way. So I think this is a very radical decision, and I think the people of this country, we should, this Move to Amend movement is very important, because this is outrageous. It really is outrageous. I don't understand how these men who consider themselves intellectuals and all this sort of stuff can make a ruling in good conscience that really reverses the history of this country.
You know, would you describe it as radical, Jamil?
Yeah, I think it sort of depends on how you look, because it does flow sort of neatly from precedent going back a couple decades. As soon as you say, as the Supreme Court did in the 70s, that money counts as speech, then it's very hard to imagine how you limit that, because there's very few limits on what you can say. I think what's radical, if there's anything radical about the ruling, what's radical is that the word systematically pulled back on the very modest limits on the role of money in politics that lawmakers have established. So we're sort of getting to the point where it's hard to imagine how lawmakers can do anything to either provide a countervailing voice for the non-rich through public financing or so on, or just limit the impact of money. It's hard to see how the Roberts Court would let any of that, given its sort of relentless decision to strike down what very modest limits we put up in the first place.
And it almost makes it impossible, doesn't it, for people who are running for office to not court all of these people who have money, because how else are you going to win?
Right. That's exactly right. And it should be emphasized, said and emphasized, that on the realm of presidential politics, this probably isn't the biggest deal, right? Because these presidential candidates are already raising, so much money that an additional $1 million or even $10 million from a couple of rich people isn't really going to change the ball game that much. The marginal value of it's very small. Where this matters is for everything else, for Senate races, for House races, for state House races, for state Senate races, for gubernatorial contests, where there's less money and thus any individual donor can have a much larger effect.
Mm-hmm.
It's there that we might see, this is what we've seen in North Carolina, right? Where a single very wealthy donor has had a tremendous amount of influence in driving the policy direction of the state through strategic use of donations. And that, I think, is something we don't want. We don't, earlier in the late 19th century and the early 20th century, we actually had a situation where a very wealthy person in their business owned an entire state legislature. That was in Montana. And many of our campaign finance laws and ideas come from reformers at the time saying it should not be the case that someone with a lot of money can buy a government.
Jamelle Bouie is our guest for All Things Political, staff writer for Slate, and we're taking phone calls. Our number, and there are a couple lines open right now, 800-486-8655, email talk@wpr.org. Willem, thanks very much for your call. Ray in Milwaukee, hello.
Hello. First, you spoke of Jeb Bush just a moment ago and also Hillary Clinton in the same statement. I think both of these people should be in jail for their past injustices to our country, but I'm not going to go into detail about that. I'm just sorry to hear they get these free plugs all the time on public radio. You know, it's a shame you even bring up their names.
All right, well, what do you want to talk about, Ray?
I want to talk about the immigration story, your guest just went through, and I'm a union member. I voted for Mr. Obama both times, and I am so disillusioned with him. I don't think I'm ever going to vote again until a person like Will Allen or a real human being in this country runs for government. The drone bombing, the torturing, you just name it. Mr. Obama has turned out to be Bush light instead of somebody who could have really changed this country. He's turned out to be the lawyer from Chicago that my friends all warned me about. They're like, you're going to be sorry voting for him. My friends were correct.
All right. Thanks for your comments. Let's go to Suzanne in Waukesha. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi.
Hi.
sorry. I called because I wanted to relate my daughter's story trying to get to vote. She just turned 18 about 2 weeks ago. And so she wanted to vote last week in the election, and we took three documents not knowing what she needed. We probably should have looked up ahead of time, but we got there, and they went over and over what she could have, and her chances, we finally ran to her school just before closing, the school closing, to try to get a piece of paper that supplemented with her other stuff would get her in to vote, because it was not easy to vote. She doesn't have a job. She doesn't pay utility bills. She doesn't drive because she hasn't had driver's ed yet. And she had just turned 18, so she had not gone for her permit yet. And the people who say it's easy to vote, that all depends on your economic and your age and various other factors.
Did you have a birth certificate? Would that have done the trick, do you think?
I don't think that was listed as it. We had a passport.
Oh. And the passport didn't work?
Passport didn't work.
Wow.
We had a student ID, but that didn't have her birth date on it. We had, and then we had a piece of mail showing she was admitted to UWM, and that didn't work because they won't take mail other than a utility bill or something.
You know what, Suzanne, if you were there with her and you said, I'm her mom and I gave birth to her on such and such a date and I verify that this is true and she is who she says she is, that would be enough for me.
Well, you know what was funny is there were even two poll workers who'd known her since birth.
Oh, goodness. Jamelle. Your comments.
I guess you have my sympathies. That sounds like a bear of a time to try,
right,
to try to get a voter registration. I think it goes to show the extent to which it actually isn't that easy to get your papers in order to be able to vote, and that laws that make it harder, that add more, you know, red tape to the process, seem very odd. I think that what we should be trying to do, given our low voter participation rates, what we should be trying to do is to make it as easy as possible for everyone to vote, And if that means sending everyone an ID free of charge, we should do that. If that means having early voting hours and weekend voting, that's what we should do.
Thank you, Suzanne, very much for your call. More phone calls in a moment. This is All Things Political, which you hear on Mondays at 1 o'clock. Jamel Bowie is our guest. He's a staff writer now for Slate. He writes about campaigns, elections, public opinion, policy, and we're looking at the Supreme Court's decision. We're looking at voter ID and cutting down on weekend voting. We are talking about the president and his deportation policy. We are talking about Jeb Bush and a little bit about Hillary Clinton. We'll get to what Jamel thinks, if that's the likely matching in 2016. And other issues. All Things Political means all things. So more phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's a Facebook comment. Your guest, Steve says, and me, just mentioned the Koch brothers and their hefty contributions to political causes. Would you please also discuss the hefty contributions of the unions, rich Soros-type Democratic donors, and whether or not they try to influence national and state political contests?
I should say, I'm not sure that I mentioned the Koch brothers. I think it was one of the callers.
I didn't mention them. But we mentioned Adelson.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, right. I don't think the issue is that people shouldn't, or that wealthy people or corporations shouldn't participate in politics. Obviously, they have a role, they have interests, so on and so forth. The issue is that some groups have more power than others. Unions aren't that powerful. A single-digit percentage of the American workforce, I think it's around 6 or 7%, is unionized. Among public sector workers, it's about 12 or 13%. But the vast majority of Americans are in unions. The vast majority of American workplaces aren't unionized. And unions, while they are a formidable influence since there's heavy union density, don't have the sort of national reach that say an oil billionaire might have. And so the problem with sort of loosening your campaign finance laws is that you end up giving effectively more power to the people with more money, and that is people like the Koch brothers. Not that they shouldn't participate, not that they shouldn't spend their money to influence the political system. That is, I think, their right as Americans. But it is our right as a public to be able to say, well, we would prefer a little less money. We would prefer a bit more restriction of what you can do.
Yeah.
Because we have, as a public, the lived experience of more government.
Well, and it's so incredible. It's so much money, Jamel, that you feel in a way like you're just... It's overboard. The last election, there was a saturation point, I think, where people had the commercials memorized and they were on the air all the time, and you just grew irritated with them, and you said, that's it, on both. I don't want to listen to this stuff anymore, and you wonder where else the money could be better spent, right? It's almost like you're taking it and throwing it out.
Right. I mean, that's one of the hopes for maybe lessening the impact of money is that maybe people just will stop paying attention. I will say that, in a house race, for instance, where the sums of money being raised aren't huge, maybe $1 billion, $2 million, or in a smaller district, $500,000, $750,000. If I had $1 billion and I had just money to spare, if I were to go into a house race and like donate, or create a super PAC that puts $1 million into this race, I can make a big impact. If I were to go to a state house race where the sums of money being spent are even smaller, say $50,000, $60,000, then a donation of $100,000 all of a sudden changes the game. I think that's what we should worry about. Not so much presidential politics, but the influence this stuff can have as you go further and further down the ladder of local politics.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Nick in Greenfield. Hi, Nick.
In Greenfield?
Yes. Hello? Nick. Hi, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, the point that I wanted to make, and I feel so bad that not only your guest, but so many people who talk about the immigration problem, they really fail to to point out that part of the cause of the illegal border crossing was because when people would apply for work visas, that the United States government was so inept that it took, in some cases, up to 12 years to process their application. So people just got tired of waiting, and they said, well, the heck with it. We're just going to go and get a job that we can send money back to our family. So part of the problem was the United States government not setting up to process legal applications for work visas.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing I'd like to say is that gentleman who called from, I guess, rural America, that he said he couldn't understand why it was that people shouldn't have IDs. It's an old saying, the Indians had, walk a mile in my moccasins. And if he had come from the rural South and been birthed by a midwife and didn't have a birth certificate and then went and tried to get all those IDs that he talked about, he'd find out how difficult it is.
Yeah, thank
so
you.
That's my comment.
Thank you, Nick, very much. You know, and he said a phrase there that I don't think we keep in mind very much. Walk a mile in my shoes, walk a mile in my moccasins. I don't think there's a lot of that going on right now in this country. It's part of our problem, Jamel. Would you agree?
No, I think that's right. I think, I mean, it's generally hard for people to sort of grok the experiences of those that aren't like them, but it's really vitally important to doing politics or making policies. It's important to see where people are coming from, even if you disagree with them. I try my best to do so. I don't always succeed. But it's, you know, that basic empathy is key. It's to go back to my, you know, comments on immigration, it's sort of why I'm broadly sympathetic to people who came across the border without proper authorization, that most of them, I would say the vast majority of them, are here just to make their lives better. And so why treat them like criminals? If someone were a citizen, I wouldn't treat them like criminals. They're trying to make their lives better. What about not being a citizen means that we should change that approach?
Yeah. Steve in Sparta is next. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Yep. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah. See, I was just wondering what your thoughts were on under Citizens United, with corporations given the same rights as individuals. I was just wondering why aren't they allowed, given the right to vote, or if you see that coming in the future. And I'll take my answer offline.
Thanks, Steve.
I don't think that even the Supreme Court will go as far as to say that corporations have the right to vote. at least I hope not. I will say that corporate personhood, although it sounds crazy to a lot of people, does have a utility, right? That it's, you know, if you and a bunch of investors start a company and an idea you have patented is stolen by another company, corporate personhood is what allows you to sue as a single entity, as a person, to get damages. The question is, you know, if the question is how much do we need this legal fiction as something representative of citizenship, of something in the real world? Is it firm enough? Is it concrete enough to allow political speech? That's what the Supreme Court has decided. Yes. Is it firm enough to allow religious belief, religious practice? The Supreme Court is deciding on that right now. Although I do not think that the court will say that corporations have the right to vote, I do share the uneasiness that many people have with the idea that corporations somehow have, in addition to, you know, the economic privileges that they have, rights of citizenship equal to that of a single living, breathing person. That seems like a stretch to me.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Steve, very much for your call. And let's go to Carla in La Crosse. Hi, Carla.
Hello. Hi. I'm calling because I wanted to say that I've worked at the polls as a poll worker, and we do not attest that the person that comes in and says that they are who they are who they are. And so a voter ID, an ID that someone presents is not going to, I mean, the poll worker is not going to be the person attesting to that person's ID. So it's still the person that's voting's responsibility to represent themselves at the poll. Thanks. That's all I want.
All right. Thank you. Thanks very much for the call. John in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. 2 points on the Republican Party convention in Las Vegas. It's very, very typical. It could have been the Democratic Party, but you connect them to the type of business that Las Vegas operates, their connection to Adelson, Adelson's connection to Macau gambling operations, which is owned by Red China and Adelson. And then you go on to the 300 American families that own over half the country of America, the United States of America.
It's actually 400.
That by constitutional amendment, they should be prohibited from contributing to any political party or any political information just for the sake of democracy so that the people can finally have something to say about what goes on in this country.
All right. Thank you so much for your call. I promised I'd ask about Jeb Bush's being everywhere the last couple of days. You know, it's kind of weird that of all the people who live in America, it could be a Bush-Clinton run in 2016. Isn't that strange, Jamel? If it should happen.
It's it is strange, though I can see how it happens, right? On the Republican side, if there's, you know, there is not enough data here to make a trend, but if you're going to be a little cheeky, you'd look at the last, you know, 60 or 70 years of elections, and one thing stands apart. The only time Republicans have won the presidency is with a Bush on the ticket, at least since the 60s, or not since the 60s, wrong, since the 70s. That's Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush as VP. That's George H.W. Bush. That is George W. Bush. And so, you know, you could joke that it stands to reason that Jeb Bush would be the one. And it also is true that among Republican donors, among sort of the Republican establishment class, Jeb Bush has wide support. They believe as a former governor of Florida, as someone with deep connections to the Latino community, that he could compete nationally. So on the merits, he seems like a good candidate, and I think that's why people are gravitating towards him. As for Hillary Clinton, I mean, you know, she has been, in addition to being the former first lady, she emerged in 2008 as really the other major leader of the Democratic Party, more so than anyone else. She aside from Barack Obama, is sort of an uncontested figure in the party. And so it's only natural that, you know, looking to 2016, we would look at these two people as being, you know, front runners. That it's a restatement of, you know, Bush Clinton from 1992 is odd. I think it's more a quirk than anything else. I mean, it's not as if political dynasties are unusual in American politics. They go back to the beginning of the country. See John Quincy Adams and John Adams.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, that's I think where we're coming to the place where we are. Just for a variety of circumstances, these are two candidates who seem to stand apart from the pack.
Yeah. Oh, what a country, huh? What a time. Jamel, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Jamel Bowie, he's been with us before for All Things Political. He has become, just very recently, a writer for Slate. Before that, he was with the Daily Beast. His work has appeared in The Nation, The Atlantic, CNN.com, The Washington Post. He writes about elections, campaigns, policy, and public opinion. And we thank him very much for being with us this hour. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour, and to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. If you ever have suggestions for guests for All Things Political, he does a whale of a job getting terrific people on, but feel free to leave messages for us on our Facebook page, where we'd love to have you continue the conversation as well. So if you didn't get on the air today or your thoughts didn't, go to our Facebook page and we'll read what you have to say. We'd like to. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. News is coming up momentarily. from NPR, and we'll return with another hour.